The Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Friends and enemies, welcome to yet another edition of the CBP. 3 days in a row. This is an oddity. We don't tend to do this, but here we are. Joey has the evening off. Good for him. And I'm going to be manning this ship solo, but not really solo because I have two good guests coming on, Mitchell and Ray. And we'll be talking about the ag sector. This is going to be a dynamite show. But before we get into it, I just want to talk about our sponsor, EasyDNS. And well, we are in the process of opening up our own website using their services because they have web hosting, email hosting, domains you could purchase through their service, DNS hosting, NIP5. So if you are a Nostr guy and you want to have your NIP5, well, they're able to provide you that as well. Nostr relays, again, Nostr stuff, anything that's Nostr related is A-OK by me. And you could also pay with your Bitcoin. Actually, I even want to say that Mark, the owner, has provided me a copy of his book, Unassailable. So think this is the guy that's behind the EasyDNS company. So Unassailable, for anybody that's writing a book like that, is all right with me. But without further ado, I want to bring in the guests, and we could discuss a little bit about the agricultural sector in Canada. Gentlemen, Mitchell and Ray, how are you guys?
Doing good. Great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So we'll start with Mitchell, I guess. Tell us a little bit of history about yourself, really how you got into Bitcoin and where are you at with your Bitcoin journey?
Yeah, so thanks for having me, Len. I grew up in southwestern Ontario, about an hour north of London, and in a rural setting my entire life. My grandpa was a farmer, had hogs, and was a cash cropper as well. So I grew up around tractors and machinery every day and kind of that rural lifestyle. In high school, I worked on a dairy farm for 3 years and then went off to university for mechanical engineering. And that kind of brings me to where I am now, working for an agriculture equipment manufacturer that makes feed mixers for dairy and beef. So kind of been ag adjacent my whole life. And how that has aligned with Bitcoin, it was kind of a several year orange pilling for me with a couple of friends throughout university into my kind of early career. And it wasn't until coming back from working in the US for a year amidst the pandemic and the vaccine passport, social issues that we were having, that was kind of the, all of a sudden, now I understand what value Bitcoin has to add in my life. So since then, the last couple of years, been slowly building my understanding on the kind of software side, on the energy mining side, kind of the full picture. And would really like to get into it today with you guys on how that can grow in the ag sector, because I see a lot of potential, obviously, as one of the most important industries to the human success. So,
oh, hell yeah. There's a lot of overlap here. So definitely we'll dive into that. But Ray, I want to hear about you. What's your story? How did you get into Bitcoin and where are you at in your Bitcoin journey?
Yeah, so it's a real honor to be on here as well tonight. Thanks for having me. So I was born and raised in southwestern Ontario as well. Raised on a hog farm, and my dad was a farm machinery mechanic. So I did chores morning and evening and fixed tractors through the day. And been around farming the rest of my life. All my family is still either farming or very closely working to the farming community. So yeah, farming is kind of just what I was born into. I don't know if it's really a passion more than just the way it's gone for me. And my dad sold the farm back in, it's like 25 years ago or so. And I wasn't able to buy it. And I've spent a lot of years trying to buy real estate ever since that. Buying a farm was out of reach, so buying other real estate was the next second best target. So I spent a lot of years saving up to try to do that and working a construction job in the farming community, so mostly building barns and that kind of thing, and just trying to save money and just realizing you're not getting anywhere. And so that kind of led me to look for something that can store value, save money, and do what every other Canadian is doing through real estate, which is they're building wealth through real estate. Farms, in my community, it's farms, but other people, it's real estate of other kinds. And so just trying to run on that treadmill, and eventually it led me down the gold rabbit hole and hard money, and then eventually found BTC through that. So that was in 2020. And then, of course, with everything that happened in 2020, of course, accelerated my progression into Bitcoin. As I really saw the need for it outside of just as a savings tool, it also works as, a freedom tool. So that's kind of, and then my interest in Bitcoin as it relates to farming is because I'm familiar with the farming community. I think as most Bitcoiners do, that there's this parallel economy that's being built, or it's rising up, whether it's by design or by accident, because of the problems in the current system. There's a need for a value-to-value exchange mechanism, right? And so as that's growing, I really am asking the question, what is going to happen as the old system begins to kind of fade away and die? How does value for value get exchanged? And especially as, the agricultural products, like the food that we eat, as the products that are in demand change, how does that look like because of farms being set up the way they are to produce fiat foods, and the farm's dependency on fiat financing and all this kind of thing? And how does that transition look?
So you mentioned something that 25 years ago, your family sold off the farm. Was this part of, because when I'm looking at the agricultural sector, there seems to be an amalgamation, almost like in the mining sector, the Bitcoin mining sector, there seems to be companies just merging together. This is happening quite rapidly in the ag sector, is it not?
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't know if Mitchell wants to speak to this, but absolutely. And that is, as margins get thinner and thinner, and as farmers need to lean into these fiat, I call it fiat. And I also want to say, by the way, before I get too carried away, but I really do respect the farmers in my life and the farmers I work with. They're some of the most hardworking people. They're some of the most responsible, respectful people that I know. And I don't mean anything that I'm saying as a slam against anybody personally. It's just, I think the fiat system has screwed us all, right? And farmers as well. And so they've had to kind of lean into these fiat financing, fiat production practices to go into like an industrialized farming, like whatever climate or whatever, in order to try to keep up. And so it's kind of a go big or go home is kind of a thing that we hear a lot in farming is go big or go home. So that means either you sell the farm or you buy more farms and you produce more at a lower price. So your margin gets smaller and smaller all the time, but you've got to produce more to make the same money. So yeah, there's a lot of these family farms that are getting sold out, have been probably for generations already. It's trending that way and it's kind of accelerating. And so the family farms are disappearing and these big, massive industrialized outfits are kind of taking over.
Yeah, I can relate a lot to what Ray's saying there, except it goes one generation farther back for me. And it was my grandpa that had to, he didn't sell the farm, but it wasn't feasible for any of his children. So my dad and his brothers and sisters to take over. And in fact, there was, this would be early 1980s. Grandpa wanted to put up a 40 sow barn, went to the bank and said, I mean, that's really the only option. Go to the bank, ask for a loan. And they said, we'll finance a 400 sow barn, but not your 40 sow barn. So take 10x the capital, 10x the risk. And he said, no, I don't have the manpower. I don't want to hire 5-6 employees and scale my farm that way. I just want to get a little bit bigger. And they said, no. And this is a pattern that has really trended, as Ray was saying, The amalgamation of farms, it's just like the trends we're seeing in the banking sector in the US right now, where the big guys buy up the little guys because they can't afford to keep going, and their next generation can't afford to take over because of how much the property, the quota values, the equipment values have been inflated, that your only option is sell, live off the proceeds of selling your operation, or double down and go into even farther debt and scale just to keep the same revenue streams. So you look at the farmers now, they're sitting on tens of millions of dollars of equity, but they're living off scraps in terms of actual profit, even though their operations are bigger and bigger and bigger. So it's really something that has been 50, 60 years in the making. But as you said, continues to accelerate in that amalgamation direction.
So we've talked behind the scenes, Mitchell, before we started the show. And one of the things you were talking about is the leverage that these farmers are undertaking right now. And because Ray was talking about this as a parallel economy that we're going through right here, the fact that we're having these high interest rates that are being pushed upon us, at least comparatively to what we had a few years ago, how is this going to be impacting farmers that are leveraged? Are they going to be feeling the pinch and it's going to come rapidly? And then how are they going to be able to manage that? Because they're not agile enough, it doesn't seem like. They just have their land and what they sell. So what are your thoughts? What will be happening moving forward with all these leveraged farmers out there?
Yeah, definitely. If you're servicing a ton of property debt, livestock, your equipment continually getting more and more expensive. Just like anything else, just servicing that debt off your revenues is going to continue to get harder and harder. But what it seems like farmers have done in the past and continue to do is just continue to kick the can down the road, go bigger, in order to keep growing. And what you're going to see is more and more farmers give up the ghost, basically, and be forced to sell. And the rate of farmers, like the dairy industry especially, like the number of dairy farmers is shrinking rapidly. So you'll either see the big guys come in and buy them up, or the foreign corporations, which you're seeing around where I grew up, several Chinese and other international conglomerations are buying up farms. So you're either going to see it go to foreign investment, or the few big guys remaining that they have so much equity that the banks are still willing to finance them.
Yeah. And grain elevators is one it's also getting amalgamated. I know there's one just down the road from me here, and it's just recently been bought out by a big company that's been buying up every grain elevator. And so they pretty much, like, it's kind of like the banking system in the United States, where the small banks are failing and everything's getting amalgamated up to the big ones. And that's, our food supply is more and more being managed by less and less players. And it's the same way with like beef packers. There used to be quite a few beef packers, but anymore, from what I understand, there's like two beef packers in all of Canada, two big companies that slaughter beef. Wow. And that's it. And so it's just, you get a monopoly on it. And so you get less and less vote on how they do it, as far as if they're using ethical practices to slaughter, or to, you know, how do we know what all they inject into our meat, that kind of thing. So it gives you less optionality to go somewhere else and get your food elsewhere. And that's where the parallel economy is already springing up, as all of us, we've talked about this before, but we, you know, finding our other food sources and having it butchered, processed ourselves, or doing it ourselves. And that is, you know, that is that parallel economy coming. But another point I want to make about the farmers and feeling the pinch with the financing, the interest rates and all this is so these guys that have bought up a number of farms that are now, they're working a couple hundred acres or a couple thousand acres. So they go out and get new equipment, and this stuff is so specialized anymore. You know, you buy a corn planter that does nothing but plant corn or maybe soybeans, but that's all it does. And you're spending probably $100,000 or a couple hundred thousand dollars on a corn planter. And so what happens when the market pivots and they don't want corn or soybeans anymore? And your whole operation is set up to grow corn and soybeans. And so that's what, like, I want to say a big percentage of the workable farmland in Southern Ontario is cultivated by people that are set up to do just one thing or three things, typically corn, soybeans, and wheat, as far as cropping goes. And that's all they're set up for. And so when it changes, like, we think hyper Bitcoinization is going to happen overnight, depending how much of an accelerationist we are, right? But even if it happens over months or a year, it's way too fast for the farming community to be able to shift. So I don't know what that's going to look like, but I like to spend a lot of time on game theory just to think about that and wonder how that's going to happen. And the same with the other livestock production guys are set up to do one thing, and that's all they're set up for. And like, let take poultry farmers, you know, there's these big industrially raised or mass produced chicken, and the barns are dungeons, right? Which I don't want to get into the animal rights or whatever, but it's just the way they raise them is very industrial, and they're pushed hard. The birds are pushed so hard that they grow them so fast that the legs can hardly hold them up, right? So they grow them as fast as they can without their legs buckling out from underneath them. And then they kill them at a young age and grind them up into chicken nuggets. And so somebody that wants good chicken doesn't want to go to a barn like that for their chicken. Like, I know we did it all the time. I have a very close family member that's a poultry farmer. And they would always leave birds behind after they caught birds. And we would go in and catch them. And we'd raise them for another, like, 4 or 5 weeks. We'd put them out into, like, an outdoor pasture kind of thing and feed them some grain. And they would, with time and the proper feed, they would turn into nice meat animals. And we'd butcher them and have them eat. But we were never interested in those fake fiat garbage birds that got shipped off to grind into McDonald's nuggets.
But so it gets one step worse than that, even with the quota system too, because if your birds don't meet weight, they gas the barns, get rid of the ones who didn't meet weight, and throw them in the manure pile, and then start over every 6 weeks. So you've got quite a bit of waste on the too heavy and too small end of the broiler market. So even worse than just what Ray was saying is there's a lot of waste tied up in, because you can't put those birds to market, but you can't sell them either. You can give them away, like what Ray was saying, and then raise them privately for another little while. But the quota system, the packers don't want those.
Another quota system, I think, that's in Canada, maybe you guys could shed some light on this, is with milk. And correct, some time ago, I think after COVID hit and they shut down the borders and the economy, essentially, they were pouring tens of thousands of liters of milk down the drain. So, and you guys want to talk about this as well? Isn't there some sort of cartel that is overseeing this? And I mean, I want to hear what your thoughts about this is. I only hear a little bit about this. Maybe you can give some insight into it.
Yeah, the milk marketing board would be that cartel. But pouring milk wasn't new to the pandemic. That's something you have to do at any time if you overproduce, or there's a snowstorm and the milk truck can't come. So that's actually a real problem at the dairy farm I worked at. We had a big snowstorm, power was out. Obviously you got backup power on the farm, but milk truck couldn't get to the farm, and you got to pour. Your tanks only got enough for 2 days worth of production with a little bit of buffer if he misses one pickup. But if it goes longer, you're pouring milk. Mm-hmm. When you had during the pandemic, I was out of the country, I think, at that time. But if the processing facility for the milk has had a COVID outbreak and they shut down capacity, they had to dump milk. And this is a little background on the milk quota system. It was basically decreed in the late 60s. All dairy producers were kind of battling price fluctuations. So the natural central control processes came into play in this industry too, where we're going to control price, we're going to control production, and we're going to control imports. So basically control the competition. And they gave all the existing dairy farmers X amount of quota based on the amount of butter fat the cows produce. And over time, that quota, which was granted to those original farmers when there was way more of them, started to develop a market value. And that market value continued to inflate because you couldn't produce milk. You couldn't enter the industry unless you owned the quota. So if you wanted to grow your herd, you had to buy it from somebody else. And I believe Ray might know a little bit more, but they added quota to the system, obviously, as demand increased within reason, as the population has increased since the late 60s. But really, the only way to enter the industry now is to buy quota, which is now price fixed at 24K, I believe, here in Ontario, because of how fast it was accelerating value. So now all these dairy farmers don't not only have tons tied up in land, tons tied up in equipment and livestock, they've got millions and millions of dollars tied up in quota, which is just a fiat thing created out of thin air, with the intent of controlling or leveling the profits of the farmers and keeping, you know, if you notice, the price of milk's always the same, and then it'll like everywhere will increase by the same amount. It's because it's completely controlled. But now you've got the problem where the consumer can't afford the milk and the dairy producer can't afford to make it. Like, their margins have shrank so much. So the intent of the system was to prevent both of those things from happening. And the result is producers can't afford to produce and consumers can't afford to consume. And that's kind of where we are today. I don't know if you want to build on that, Ray.
Yeah. The dairy quota system. So there is quota for dairy, and milk. Milk is dairy, obviously. Eggs and poultry, I think, are the three things that have quota. So right now, pigs and beef are not under quota in Ontario. I don't know about other parts of Canada, how that is out there. But the dairy quota is a little bit different than the eggs and the poultry. They do have it. It has made smaller farms. So in the States, they have these huge farms where they kind of mass produce milk. And I think it's pretty well understood that the U.S. milk quality is lower than Canadian milk. And part of what contributes to the Canadian milk products being better is because of the quota system keeping dairy farms smaller. So because the milk is subsidized by the milk board, they get more money for their milk, so therefore they're more profitable, so they don't have to milk as many cows, and there's also more regulation about what they can do. But typically the farms are much, much smaller here, and then they have the animals are cared for better, the practices are much better, they're kept in much cleaner barns and that kind of thing. So it sounds like I'm arguing for the milk board here.
I would agree with all those points as well.
Yeah. So I'm saying it kind of cuts both ways. And what it really is, it's because they're unfairly subsidized by the consumer. So the consumer is paying for a dairy farmer to be able to live a standard of life that is not attainable for other farmers. And it's made a lot of division within the farming community. There's a lot of people upset about it. But then at the same time, they're also slaves to those dairy farmers, are still slaves to those systems. And as the quota price went too high, like Mitchell was saying, it went too high, so they capped it because we can't have it getting too expensive. So we've got central planners involved at every step. Every time something goes wrong, another central planner steps in and puts in another regulation. And so they capped it. And now to get more production, they hand out free quota to those who already have it. So really what the quota system does is it subsidizes milk production. So it steals money from the consumer and gives it to the farmer. And then it also at the same time bars entry into the dairy farming by denying entry. You can't produce milk unless you buy this quota. And now it's almost impossible to get the quota. You got to go on some waiting list or something like that, and once they see fit to bestow upon you the right to produce milk, then you've got to be ready to go within so much time. So I'm not real sure on all the details about that, but basically they got everybody locked into these pens and you do this and you do that. And we're going to force the consumer to pay for the milk. I just looked it up today. Milk in Canada is on average, there's a lot of variables. There's a lot of different ways of looking at this and measuring this. But if you look at the Canadian Milk Report from 2023, it looks like milk in Canada is on average about 59% more expensive than in the States for a liter of milk. I just messaged a good friend that lives in the States. He is a dairy farmer. Asked him what his milk is costing him right now. He's just recently moved to Montana. And then I asked my wife, what are we paying for milk here in southwestern Ontario? And the difference is about 25% higher. So that's not as bad as according to the Canadian Milk Report. But so we're paying a lot more for our dairy products here in Canada to subsidize the farmers, who then in turn get regulated to no end and can't, they're within parameters. Like you said, they have to dump milk. They can only produce so much. They have to produce this much, but they can't, the margin is very small. So if they overproduce, they have to dump. But if they underproduce, they get punished as well. So it's the furthest thing from a free market. And just more about this parallel economy coming up. And once people start buying milk, raw milk directly from the farmer, which I'm not advocating for that necessarily because it's actually legal. So just point that out. Yeah, I love raw milk myself. But when that starts to happen, as more of the dairy products go out the farmer's lane in civilians' vehicles, there's going to be less milk going into those fiat food supply chains. And how is that going to look once, like, you know, as Bitcoiners, as your neighbor comes in your lane with Bitcoin and offers to buy the produce that you're producing with Bitcoin, and it has more value than the fiat dollar does. So you're going to sell to him in favor of the other. I'm not talking just dairy. I'm talking anything, your asparagus, your beef, whatever you're raising. So you start selling to the market that has the hard money, right? So what about this soybean, this massive soybean machine that turns soybeans into, you know, fiat?
You're reading my mind. I was just going to go there.
Yeah. So once the money coming back from, like, think about wheat. Like, look at how much wheat gets grown and they turn it into Cheerios. They mass produce it, process it, and sell Cheerios to the masses. But once the money coming back from those urban centers for the Cheerios buys less and less, which is where we're at right now, because farm equipment is getting more and more expensive, land is getting more and more expensive, and the profit margins are getting thinner. I mean, on average, I don't know exactly specific years here and different crops are all different, but on average, it's trending where the profit margin is thinner and thinner. So the purchasing power of the profits goes down and equipment keeps getting more expensive. Fuel inputs, like fertilizer last year, was absolutely insane where fertilizer went to. And they need all of these inputs to try to match that production year after year. They cannot have a bad year or they're done, or most of these guys are. So they have to max it out, pump the chemicals and the spray and all this, the fertilizers and all that on the crops, to try to send that wheat into that fiat food supply chain to make Cheerios. But once that money coming back doesn't buy you anything, which is where we're kind of getting to, what are they going to do? I mean, me and Mitchell, we're going to go and say, well, stop growing that, grow me some beef and I'll pay in Bitcoin. And, you know, how does that look? Like, I've often wondered, some of these guys working 2,000 acres, they won't be able to look after 2,000 acres of grass-fed beef. There's no way. They're going to maybe do 100 or 200 acres. Mm-hmm. And what happens with the rest of that land? I guess Bitcoiners are going to move out of the city and start staking claims of abandoned land, right? I guess. I mean, but that doesn't, even if, like, that's kind of extreme, but if something like that were to happen, how many years does it take for that to happen? And what are people eating that are eating Cheerios and tofu today? What are they going to eat for the next 3 years while farming transitions mm-hmm. into producing mass quantities of food that the people actually want, or the people actually have a means? It really comes down to net producer versus net consumer, right? So the net producer is going to have a value to exchange for value. And so they come to that dairy farmer who the money he's getting for his milk products is no good anymore. Somebody drives in the lane with money that buys stuff, he's going to sell it to them. So that net producer had something of value to exchange for food, and he's all good. But all those people that are net consumers that don't have anything to exchange for value, how are they going to get food?
Yeah, what I see happening is there's going to have to be a better balance between the number of net producers to the number of net consumers. That number has gone farther and farther in the direction of more net consumers than producers. And that process of hyper-Bitcoinization in ag is going to hopefully trend that back the other way. And just one more perspective I kind of wanted to add to this quota system. If you can imagine, the amount of milk you can produce is capped, but your costs are going up and up and up. So that means your revenue is capped, but your costs are going up, profits thinning. So what options do these producers have to retain any of that profit to pay for their lives as well? Well, really all they can do is cut their costs. So what do they do to cut their costs? Well, they're over the last several decades, more and more producers are going to what are the cows eating? How do we get the most out of those cows for the least input? And it doesn't always mean that they get the best feed. Like naturally, a cow will perform the best on a primarily forage diet. So hay, corn forage, but those are very expensive to produce and also very expensive to store. It's very costly to store haylage and silage properly. So what can you do? Well, if you're banking on cheaper food storage, you can back supplement with that flaxseed and the soybean. Like a lot of soybean goes into feeding animals, even in dairy. So something that I see in my day-to-day work with the feed mixers, we're not just mixing hay and corn, we're mixing in all these other supplements. So in order to keep the cows producing on crappier and crappier intake, you've got to supplement with other stuff to kind of counteract the poor feed that the animal's eating. And I don't know how far we want to get into the kind of digestive system of a ruminant animal, but when you're constrained on your revenue and your costs are going up, you got to look to more of these fiat solutions, and you end up in this endless loop of poorer and poorer quality for these animals. So yeah, when we can get more of the ag sector onto Bitcoin and there starts to be a demand in this circular economy separate from fiat land, you're going to start seeing a return to, hey, I can improve my quality and improve my revenue automatically my bottom line outside of this hyper centrally planned system.
That's, I think it's a good segue then into how Bitcoin can fit into the mix, because ultimately if we could have, I mean, I'm looking at it from the outside looking in, and Boomer was mentioning earlier in a chat that he was purchasing some of his meat from a local farmer and he's trying to do it with Bitcoin. He's working on a process to orange pill his beef supplier, his meat supplier, but it's kind of a, you know, it's an uphill battle right now. But right now, though, the way I look at it, if we could somehow encourage or educate some of the people in the ag sector to somehow get exposure, some exposure into Bitcoin, what are your thoughts on that? And how would be the best approach to do that? I'll throw it over to you, Ray.
Yeah, it's a real good question. And it's one that I've spent a lot of time thinking about. And I'd love to, my own business in farming, I'd love to get Bitcoin, accept Bitcoin as payment. But right now, in the area I'm in, there are no farmers that know about it, are interested in it. And I don't know if I haven't answered your question, because I think Canadian normies are extraordinarily normy, and they're so built. And I kind of have to go back to what we talked about, the consolidation of farms into big farms. And so the small family farmer has lost the farm or sold the farm to the big guys. And it's those kind of people that sold the farms to the industrial guys are the kind of guys that would understand Bitcoin. And most of those farmers are on the sidelines now, or they're not farming, they're retired, or the kids that said, heck no, I'm not going to do this crazy debt up to my eyeballs and do the whole commercial farming thing. they say heck no to that. Those are the guys that get Bitcoin. It's the ones that are so fiat drunk that they have to chase every new innovation to maximize production and get even deeper into debt to buy that new sprayer to apply the new chemicals. Those kind of guys are so addicted to the fiat stimulus that they get at their low interest rate debt because they have so much debt and they have all their cash flow and all this crap that the banks like. Those kind of guys are so fastened at the hip. They're so in tune to that fiat system that it's hard to get them to think outside the box. And the kind of farmer that does get it isn't farming, and he can't farm because he can't buy land. I mean, look at us. We'd be farming, but we can't because
the
prices are absolutely mental. So, and if you wanted to buy a farm, I mean, even if you could, you'd have to show the bankers how you're going to fiat farm to pay for this thing to say that, well, I'm going to just raise some cattle and do some things and do it the right way, regardless of what the cost is or regardless what the return on investment is. We're going to do it ethically. Well, that doesn't work in fiat land, right? So it's kind of this thing of the farmers that are farming right now, although they're good guys and they're hardworking and they're doing a great job, but they're so single track minded. They're just focused on what are interest rates? Can I borrow more? Can I buy more land? Can I cash flow it? Is there a new chemical that I can apply? Is there a new drug to implant to, you know, force the cattle to grow faster? Like, that's the way they think. And to try to get in there, it's really tough. I'm really excited to see what's happening with the beef initiative down south. And it'd be awesome to try to get that kind of thing in here, but it's really hard to do. So I don't know if I have a good answer as to how to go about that.
Yeah, I was just going to say and bring up the beef initiative, because that is exactly what I would love to see here in Southwestern Ontario. But I hadn't thought about it like Ray, but he's right. They are on the sidelines. I look at my dad, same thing, couldn't take over grandpa's farm, went off to school looking elsewhere for a career. But those are the types of people that are building, like he is building a circular economy. He's now starting to grow pasture to put cattle on his land. He barters with all of his neighbors. And I look at, there's probably 8-10 other neighbors that exchange everything from Paul's got the backhoe to dig the little pond over here, or deal with your flooded basement to put in a sump pump. And dad goes over with his chainsaws and trims his trees. Like, all these things are happening, both in favors and in food. Some of us have eggs, some of us have other things growing circularly. Those are the people who are all farming oriented, but aren't running these big operations. So I see it actually starting with new farmers. If there are a way for people who have either exited farming but still have a small amount of acreage that they hung on to as a hobby farm, or I look at another one of my parents' neighbors, 4 kids, all the kids are raising their chickens and their quail and their 3 hogs. These are the people who are ripe to take on Bitcoin, and then maybe they can scale up very decentralized little pockets of circular economies that then grow outwards rather than trying to start with these massive operations. And one more point on these massive operations, often the people working on the farm aren't even the owners anymore. So you really lose touch when you're an employee working for an hourly wage, milking your cows, than when you're the owner and those cows are your lifeblood, not just your biweekly paycheck. And that's something I was lucky enough to see at the dairy farm I worked at, which was family owned, third generation, only 56 head of cattle, far different than the 500, 600, 700, 800 unit operations that we see here. And the 10,000, 20,000 head operations you see down south.
Gentlemen, do any of you guys know anything about Clarkson Farm? Because Archiving Clown World is saying about this. Do you want to talk about it? Because I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, I've seen the whole first season, big fan of Top Gear and Jeremy Clarkson. So when he rolled that out, I was pretty excited. But yeah, when you have TV money to go and buy up a farm that's already existing, that's great. But how he runs his farm and how European farms are they're not nearly quite as industrialized as they are in North America. I don't know a ton about it, but from what I saw on that show and what I know a little bit about the Dutch farmers who have left Holland, who are a lot of our farmers here now, things are a little bit smaller scale. So yeah, the way Clarkson had his sheep and his smaller, very like a lot more variation in his crops, would be a step in the right direction. But yeah, it's the capital to start something like that. You just can't do.
I'm somewhat familiar with the Clarkson farm, and I agree with Mitchell that if you have TV money to get in, you know, if we had TV money to get in, we'd be in it and we could maybe change the game too. But all of us who don't have celebrity money, we lose the farm. That's what happens, because as soon as you don't mass produce whatever it is that can pay for the farm, you lose it. And another thing that I'm just thinking about here is the farmers here are not ready for Bitcoin. They think it's whatever. So they're just not ready. But what they do understand is they do understand a lot of the reasons why they should understand Bitcoin. So they're pre-coiners, I guess. And so, you know, they understand this, like, if you don't work, you don't eat, you don't plant, nothing grows. They got those concepts down. And so
something they know proof of work in a whole different way.
Exactly. So this exchanging value for value, that works. And I do it regularly. I got some pork for some construction work. I've gotten beef. I've gotten services like, you know, work done on buildings and like printing and services like that. I've got that done in exchange for construction work. So that seems to work. And I think we need to kind of lean into that and, you know, promote the idea of exchanging value for value. And then they'll eventually wake up to there's actually something that does that as a medium of exchange that takes a place where you don't have to, you know, you don't have to take the service that I do in as a form of payment. You can take Bitcoin instead. So I think they understand it, and it'll be fast to move from the dollar to Bitcoin once they get it. But right now, yet it's too far out.
Yeah, it's definitely when you're up to your knees and or up to your eyeballs, not just your knees, in daily work, you don't have time. Like the barriers to entry are still, you got to have some level of software tech capabilities, some obviously all the preconceived notions about why an uncensorable, infinitely divisible, uninflatable money is important. All those things I think are farmers are aware of. But the trust of tech definitely isn't there, even though tech in the ag industry is leading the charge. I think even compared to automotive with the advancement in equipment tech, but getting these farmers to completely phase shift their entire mindset on financial systems, is a big challenge. But if you look at what happened only a year ago, as Len realized, it wasn't 2 years ago, the trucker protest, there was parades of tractors around everywhere in Southwestern Ontario. There wasn't just the convoy to Ottawa. Every area had a tractor parade that went for miles and miles. And the basis of that whole movement came from the rural ag conglomerate, I guess, all the people that kind of think alike. And they're aware that their money can be frozen now. And I think they are awake to a lot of these problems. So yeah, I think we're closer than we may ever have been to converting some of these people over. But I definitely think we're not there yet.
We've got a question from the chat from FireAx, and he's asking what can be done to improve the food stability for Canada. Should we call MPs or ask for some lobby group? What are your gentlemen's thoughts on answering this question?
Well, calling MPs definitely isn't in my top 10. I think
it's not on my bingo card.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing I would say is try to get food from a local farmer. Try to do farm to table and increase the demand for that parallel economy. Increase the demand for farmers to sell their produce into the market that isn't through these like two tunnels, like with the beef processors. I said there's like two guys processing beef. There's 100, like I know I'm in a Mennonite community where I'm at. I know a bunch of Mennonite butcher shops that'll do like one or two cattle a day kind of thing. So it's like small. But if you use their services instead of selling all your beef, like if you give the farmer an option to sell his cattle to a place where it's processed outside of those two big plants, that is introducing this diversity and optionality, and it brings stability to the food supply system. And just, you know, even your asparagus or lettuce or whatever it is, buy it at a farmer's market or directly from a farmer instead of at the grocery store. It helps you keep it diversified. And in that is going to be a ton of strength instead of having just like Loblaws as your one source of food. And so they go on strike or there's so much game theory there that we could talk about too, but just the incompetence in some of the people that are in these key positions in the food chain that, you know, they go on strike or they have coincidences or whatever.
Have a COVID outbreak at the packing plant.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So the more there are alternate food chains and systems to bring food to market, the better off we are. And I just can't help but talk a little bit about Tomer Strohlite's film. I think it's like a year old. You guys probably know it. It's Bitcoin is Generational Wealth. And in there, he imagines a world, a bit hyper-Bitcoinized world, obviously. And in there, he talks about, he actually shows a picture of like farmland that's not just, what's the word? It's just like small farms and houses and buildings and everybody's kind of growing their own food. And so it's like very diverse and it's very, you know, the farming actually has soul and culture and there's people out there. Like really what I want to see in farming is I want to see people that are passionate about growing their animals or bringing their food to market. And they're passionate about doing it ethically and doing it the way that they think is best and trying things instead of just falling into this lane of you spray it with Roundup, you wait this much time and then you cut it off and let it dry, you know, except, you know, just follow the processes and do it on a mass scale. We do it in a unique way and it becomes art. It becomes a craftsmanship, right? And so what we need is to promote that. And I think that's what the Bitcoin world is going to look like. I think that's what we're going to have. And so you'll be able to get all kinds of variety of food and same, like beef grown different ways. And you'll have producers that are going to be, you know, famous for something that another producer does differently. And so there's going to be that variety and there's going to be a lot of beauty and color within the whole farming community. Whereas now it's just like corn, soybeans, wheat. That's what we do. That or we do eggs or we do chicken and it's all mass produced and it's all sterilized crap that we probably shouldn't be eating.
Yeah, no, even without the quota system in beef, the way that the packing plants have gone with these very centralized, massive, they're kind of like the buyer of last resort. In fact, if you have 1,000 head of beef that you want to send to market tomorrow, there's always demand through those channels. So that's just naturally where everyone sends their product. But unlike dairy and poultry, farmers can start directing those head of cattle to local butcher shops if there is a local demand. So there isn't a cartel that can prevent that. So that is probably the area of ag that makes the most sense to start. So as a consumer out there, finding local beef producers that then send their animals to a local butcher shop is the best way, buying a quarter at a time. And the best way I like to look at doing that, and it's something my family's done in the last few years, rather than going to the store for any of our beef, is rather than the stores producing the massive amounts of product and then pricing to consume it, you're basically pre-ordering that cow and consuming only what you need. So rather than an unknown production amount and then adjusting those prices to make sure it makes a way off the shelf, and obviously a bunch doesn't make it off the shelf and goes bad, it's much more demand response. The problem for these big operations is there isn't enough local demand anymore for thousands of head of cattle in a small community. And also, it's highly varying. It's not a consistent demand. So it's much harder to have one of these massive operations. That's why it works when you're raising 20 cattle. You can have your local 20, 30 families you feed. And once a year or twice a year, you butcher and you know those returning customers are coming back. But it's gone so big that it's hard to steer back from on a lot of these big producers. So definitely it is out there. I think Boomer said in the chat that there are lots of processing plants around. There's not as many as there was 30 years ago, but they are out there. And if we have to use dollars right now, we got to use dollars. But as soon as those channels are open and you've been buying cattle from someone for a couple years, then you say, hey, how about you take my Bitcoin instead of my cash? If you go from your Visa to cash to Bitcoin, that's a natural trend, and circular economy is already there. And then the only thing you got to change is the medium of exchange, rather than trying to do it all at once. Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, we'll get them running nodes in no time, and then they'll be self-sovereign. And I just want to transition. I guess the last thing I want to talk about, it's more of a Bitcoin-related question to do with farmers. And you look what's going on in Holland, in the Netherlands, and the farmers over there, they've been protesting for quite some time. And do you think that something like that could potentially bleed into Canada, in that there might be some sort of movement like that from above that pushes farmers to the point where they have to do that type of level of protest? And if that's the case, then wouldn't that be the catalyst for introducing them to Bitcoin?
Yeah, I think Mitchell probably has a better answer to this one than I do, but I think that definitely we could see it here. I don't know that we will just real soon. Well, I shouldn't even speak to that, but it definitely can happen here. And I know that there was talk of this fertilizer, reducing fertilizer nitrogen specifically, that they wanted to cut that. I don't think it's anywhere near as extreme as what Holland is trying to do. But I think that kind of thing could come here. But I don't know how that Bitcoin, it's a little too late for Bitcoin by then, by the time they're forcing you off your farm. I mean, Bitcoin is still nice because you can maybe move to another country and start farming there. Mm-hmm. So it's still good. But as far as if the government has that much power that they can forcibly close your farm, we need the Bitcoin. We need to go hyper Bitcoin before that, so that that doesn't happen.
Yeah, and this is something that's been going on for the last 30 years in Holland. If you ever driven around southwestern Ontario, you see a lot of the family names on dairy farms are Dutch. And that's because it's not just the last couple of years. For a couple of generations now, they've been being pushed out of their farms. The one interesting thing is they were allowed to leave with their cash. A lot of countries prevent you from taking your money when you leave the country. I know when my mother's family left Egypt, they can only take $100 or $200 per person. So they sent the rest of the family savings in Persian rugs and some gold bracelets across to Canada. But the Dutch were allowed to leave with their money, so they're able to buy up farms here. If my understanding over there is that's just gotten worse and worse and worse. And it's been this cap on nitrogen, which is so ridiculous because we forced farmers in the direction of fiat, supplement the hell out of your land, get the most out of it you can. Then you got to use the nitrogen to replenish it because you can't do it naturally. Oh, and now we're going to rug pull you on your nitrogen usage. And that just, if you can't use the nitrogen, you're underwater on your production and you're losing money now. So there's that over there. And then here we banned we tax a huge amount of the Ukrainian and Russian fertilizer imports. Well, the farmers couldn't just not buy the fertilizer. They were forced to buy it, but we had to buy it here at a 30% markup. So those tariffs on things like that when your farm is so close to breaking even, mm-hmm. all of a sudden puts you under. So yeah, if we continue to see these kind of clown world solutions to manage farmers from afar without actually understanding how they're operating, like getting your nitrogen usage cut, or like being run off your farm for the expansion of housing. I mean, we're seeing that in the GTA. That's going to accelerate as we're like, oh, the green belt, we're not going to care about that anymore. Let's just expand Brampton and Mississauga infinitely. And yeah, those farmers are going to get a lot of money for those, their the sale of those farms. But in the long run, that's going to really hurt our production of what we need to eat here. So I don't know if we have one of these mass events that, I mean, we have seen farmers protest already with the convoy, but will it be to the extent that we're seeing in Holland? It's going to take a lot. But I agree, if we don't have some of the circular economies, even if it's not with Bitcoin, but more developed, it might be too late.
How well said. And now, before we sign things off, I'm just going to hand it off to you. If you guys have any topics that you want to bring up that's burning that we haven't talked about today, this is your opportunity before we sign off the show. So if there's anything that you want to bring up and just run with it, I mean, go ahead. That's a no. So that's good.
I think we got pretty deep into the subject matter, I think, today. I guess one thing I kind of wanted to get a little bit more is, what can, from your perspective, as a fairly new Bitcoiner, Len, what can I do better on like the orange pilling of people I know to break that ice on the, cause you're far better with the tech side of it. So a lot of these people that in our circles, Ray and I, aren't there. Is it going to be these really easy layer two solutions where you don't have to run your own node or have this confusing calculator device? Is that where it's going to be, or can we bridge that gap? Because we got to remember, these people we're talking about don't have the time or the experience with this kind of stuff. So where do we think Bitcoin is going to go in the next couple of years? Because if we're going to get hyper Bitcoinization, it's, in my opinion, it's going to be layer two, layer three kind of stuff. We're going to be the early adopters working on layer one. So do we need to kind of accelerate towards the layer two and not just dive in with, you need to run a node, you need to hold your own keys, even though that's what I would do. What do you think about that?
It's a good, very good question. And I've thought about this quite a bit recently too. And the reason why is, depending on what happens with the network fees moving forward, and we kind of had an idea how we would operate in a high network fees environment once the ordinals and inscriptions and BRC20 tokens came into existence. And it was just, people were realizing that on-chain fees, just, it wasn't economically feasible to do it. Like the one sat per V-byte, those days are now, at least it looks like they're gone. Who knows if they'll return back. So people will probably have to migrate and use a layer two solution moving forward. But I say that, and I'm also like torn with the fact, by doing that, a lot of that is custodial. And unless you're running your own Lightning node, and there's a technicality that goes along with it, you're relying on somebody else to hold on to your Bitcoin. And it almost defeats the purpose, because right now it's not just fiat the way we operate in it, in that it's just getting inflated away. But it's also, for the most part, we're trusting somebody else, normally the bank or an investment firm or whatever, depending on where you park your money, to ensure that the money doesn't get lost. And even when using like something like Lightning, custodial Lightning, which it all is, I believe, you're relying on somebody to ensure that it doesn't get lost as well. So I that's a really good question. I don't know. I still encourage people, even though in a high fee environment, learn the process to secure your own Bitcoin, to learn how to use a wallet, something like Sparrow, along with Coldcard. And I understand there's a technicality to that. And looking at it from an outsider looking in,
it may seem like a daunting task, a very difficult hill to climb. But I stand by this notion in that we are, this day of age, most people have the technical knowledge to do it. It's not that difficult to secure your keys. It's not that difficult to run Sparrow. It's not that difficult to exhibit good privacy habits. It's tough to break the old habits, but I think we could all do that. Are people willing to do that? That's the real question, because I think they're very, very used to the conveniences of like having your phone, looking at it and it opening up. That's bad in a way. Like, you're giving up so much, the biometric data you're giving up, and they'll continue. If they do that, what are they going to do with their Bitcoin? I think they're also go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say, no one has been able to use themselves or trust themselves for a long time. Like my generation in my mid 20s, we want to offload and outsource as much trust and responsibility in every possible way. People don't take ownership for themselves nearly as much as they used to. So, and that definitely goes for your banking. We even saw that some people at the Bitcoin conference are trying to look at recover thing with Ledger. Like, there's a huge market for people who don't understand or even care about the core principles of Bitcoin and self-sovereignty that are willing to actually pay somebody else. So rather than just take it in their own hands. So I do think there's going to be a lot of people, especially when you see these big organizations, big farms or big corporate funds that aren't going to go and hold their own. They're going to want to have some insurance company responsible, just offload as much responsibility elsewhere. And I guess to build on my question, is Bitcoin dead in the water if a large amount of the population doesn't want to take the sovereignty self-responsibility side, but they still get the hard money? We still can't have government money printing, and there'll be a lot more accountability when you have a hard currency. So can we have both? Like, is it beneficial for the people who hold their own keys? They get the self-sovereignty and the uninflatable money, I guess. That's not really a good term for it, but you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And then the majority of people just take the hard money side.
I'm going to just refer to what Clown, Archiving Clown World, says at the bottom. He says, let farmers get their bank account frozen and they'll learn about Bitcoin real quick, 100%. Yeah. Once you go through an event that you get screwed over to get access to the funds that you work so hard to accumulate, that would be the catalyst for somebody to realize, man, you know what, just securing your own keys is not that difficult, and the benefits from doing so is immense. So somebody just has to get rugged severely before
That may accelerate the process.
Given what's transpired in the past year and change, anything is possible. And he also, I'm assuming he's a he, they, them, I don't know. She,
there's a rainbow-colored icon. There,
so. Pick a John Deere colored node for those on the audio side of things. That is brilliant. And that may be one way to spur some interest. But also, Boomer was writing earlier that heating some of your chicken coops, for instance, with an S9 or multiple S9s may be an option. KYC free sats and heating up your chicken coop at the same time. So a lot of options.
That's a whole other discussion, is how you could integrate Bitcoin energy mining and ag. I think there's a huge parallel that can be developed there. You've seen it in the energy industry, bringing that over. I know I've seen of people using S9s in greenhouses. Like, it's a perfect solution. And I think for the hardcore maxis, that'll continue to grow. I just hope to get mass adoption. I think there are going to be concessions made by a lot of people who are just naturally predisposed to make massive amounts of concessions with their freedom.
Yeah, I think that in order to get Bitcoiners to self-custody, or farmers to self-custody, right now they're so busy. Like Mitchell has made that point a couple times. They got so many, they're juggling balls, and they got so many balls in the air that they don't have time. Like I grew up like this, and you know, we got up early, went out, did chores, came in, ate breakfast, then we went to the shop and we worked, came in for supper, and went to the barn and worked again, did chores. And there was no time. And a lot of these guys that are trying to run this fiat treadmill of debt servicing payments, they have no time to think about any of this stuff. I love to imagine that world in the future where a farmer has time to fart around with S9s in the chicken coop and self-custodying and do all the self-sovereign stuff and have time to think about being self-sovereign. But where we're at right now, the people that we depend on for our food supply, that the world depends on for the food supply, they're run ragged. They're the slaves of the modern day. And the last thing they're worrying about is what Bitcoin is, you know. And I agree, like, to accelerate it, some trouble would accelerate that with frozen bank accounts and that kind of thing. But I'm afraid that those kinds of things are going to have pretty big implications too with somebody's pantry being empty. And I don't think the world realizes, like, I'm not like there's a food shortage out there. It's just we're so dependent on such a small percentage of the population to produce the food we're consuming, and even such a small in terms of square miles of land that's producing the food we're eating, it's so small. And so we're so dependent on them. And as we use every new technology, like to Jeff Booth's point, we use every new technology and we milk it dry to pad the pockets of the people in the ivory tower when the people that should be realizing the yield from this technology, they don't get it. They just have to work harder. They just have to farm more land and have less time. And it's absolutely crazy. So something else is going to have to shift, in my opinion, before we can really get that environment where a farmer can even learn what an S9 is to go put it in his chicken coop, let alone even have a chicken coop, because he's so busy working 24/7 milking cows, he's got no time for a chicken coop or whatever. So there's so much that has to change there. And I'm very bullish on that future, that, like I said, Tomer Strohlite imagining this world where, you know, with this very multicultural, beautiful, soulful, artful world, where you can grow your own food because you have the time, you have the money, you want to do it, you can do it. Whereas now, you know, people, and it's not just farmers, it's people making mortgage, you know, debt slaves making mortgage payments in the city. They don't have time to learn how to source their own food or even grow their own food in the backyard. A lot of them are working two jobs to try to make ends meet. And so we just really need to get away from the parasite that's draining us all dry from our blood, sweat, and tears, and allow us to get some margin, get some lee room that we can go out and learn about Bitcoin, learn about food, learn about healthy living, right? So it's all about truth and justice. I can't wait till truth and justice and hard money is the standard, and it's available, which it is available already. It's just you can't cut through that barrier of normie world and distraction and busyness that you can't get through. And that's where farmers are at right now too.
We are going to win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if we continue to have conversations like this, that can reach those farmers in the cab of their tractor or on the barn radio, that's a great pathway forward. So,
gentlemen, just want to thank you very much. We went a little over the allotted time, so I want to thank you very much for being flexible with your scheduling. And before we close things off, just going to hand it off to you folks. So we'll start off with Ray. Ray, where can people find you? What's up with you moving forward? And the floor is yours.
Yeah, so I'm not very active on social media, but you can follow me at Ray Brubaker. That's my name.
How do you spell it in case they want to?
It's Brubacher. And first name Ray, so at Ray Brubaker. So you can follow me there. Otherwise, I'm just doing construction in southwestern Ontario, hoping to get plugged into Bitcoin economy as much as I can. Until that's an option, it'll be value for value. I'll come build something for you if you want to pay in Bitcoin or if you want to pay in beef or eggs or anything else. And yeah, that's where I'll be.
And Mitchell, same question to you. Where can people find you? What's going on with you for the next little while? And yeah, the floor is yours.
Yeah, like Ray, I'm not too active on social media, but if you want to chat more, feel free to reach out to Len and he can connect us. And mm-hmm. yeah, last few closing words, do your best to find all the necessities that you can. So beef, eggs, fruits, vegetables, locally. And it can be done. And the more people that do it, the more that those producers will see the market growing and hopefully more people can enter the market. And we can build that from the ground up and then throw in Bitcoin where you can. And hopefully that leads us to a hyper Bitcoinized ag and food industry in the region.
We will get there. Just a matter of when, not if. So gentlemen, Mitchell, Ray, thank you for coming on the show. And well, for everybody that's listening or watching us, next time we're going to be on the air, we'll be Monday. So until then, have a wonderful rest of the week and weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.